Civilization tried to destroy itself. The city degenerated into a total fear zone. And the citizenry, cocooning in their homes, afraid to go out. People just wanted the madness over. So when I saw the chance to make things right, I seized it. If I had not, the radiance of San Angeles would not be here. Just your rotting cesspool of hate and suffering. Which would you prefer?
History is strange. It's alien. And it won't give us what we would like to have.
Hour three of this Tuesday morning, the 2nd of April, 2024, being brought to you by the McPherson Financial Group. If it's hour three of a Tuesday, it's Dave Does History. Dave Bowman, been with us all day. He will bring us Dave Does History in this hour. But before we go there, Dave, just to wrap up our second hour, I got a text from my buddy Randy. Tried to call, couldn't get in. He said, a scientist gets to call it hypothesis. A cop gets to call it a hunch, or let's go with reasonable suspicion leading to probable cause. History teachers call it research. All are biased until proven or disproven, which as a cop, that's what we did. You work to prove or disprove whatever you had in front of you. He said, conspiracy is the beginning of refusing to listen, just saying it's a conspiracy. Again, we talked about things having enough merit to warrant an investigation. If it's got that, let's go with it and look at it. You can't discount something always off the top of your head.
Not usually, no.
Yeah, so that's where we are. Speaking of such things, do we have a conspiracy budding here in this story about America's entry to World War I?
I wouldn't call this story the conspiracy, but there are certainly a number of conspiracies that are related. On April 2nd, the evening of April 2nd, 1917, so this day 106 years ago, thereabouts, President Woodrow Wilson stood before a very excited Congress and congressional gallery that was packed, and he asked the nation, he asked Congress, to declare war on Imperial Germany. Now, this was strange because just 4 months before, he'd been reelected on the campaign slogan, quote, he kept us out of the war, unquote. But in another strange way, this was really the penultimate moment for Wilson. This was the moment that he was finally going to get to start to accomplish what he believed he was born to do. He would ask Congress, already knowing the answer, to have the nation declare war and to follow his leadership into a war that he said would make the world safe for democracy. Now, we are told that he spent the night before in a small office off the East Wing, pouring out his soul to a friend of his who also happened to be a newspaper reporter. He told this friend that he was terrified for the nation, that he believed that the war, while necessary, would destroy the United States as a free nation, that the Constitution would be shredded to pieces, and the very freedoms on which the nation had been founded and had stood would be erased. But standing before Congress the next evening, he showed no signs of any such concerns or fears. He informed Congress that we, quote, are the champions of the rights of mankind, unquote. And to thunderous applause and joyous acclaim, the nation would rally behind his words and we would go over there. There would be some resistance to the whole thing, but in the end, go we would. And almost 500,000 Americans would never come home.
The story behind it as we continue in 60 seconds on Bill Mick Live. America's entry into World War I, so President Woodrow Wilson, Dave, has all these concerns, yet thinks war is necessary. Doesn't raise the concerns when he says we got to go to war.
Well, that's what we're told. We're told this moving story that a prescient Woodrow Wilson was deeply concerned that the Constitution would be shredded, that we would lose these freedoms, all of which turned out to be true. The problem is, of course, that story, but we'll get there along the way.
Okay.
The U.S. entry into World War I, this moment that has brought Wilson to standing on this stage, standing in front of Congress at this particular point, is really not all that arguable. There's three primary reasons why the United States enters World War I, and Wilson outlines these pretty well. Number one is that Germany has declared unrestricted submarine warfare again. In 1917, they redeclare unrestricted submarine warfare. This is a sticking point with Americans because ships get sunk and Americans who are on those ships die, like what happened on the Lusitania in 1915. Now, is it a conspiracy theory that maybe the government put American citizens on those ships going into harm's way so that they would be sunk by the Germans? He said sarcastically, but maybe Americans are just stupid and don't read the newspapers. Who knows? But it's this unrestricted submarine warfare that really is the driving point, because Americans and the American government see this as a violation of their rights on the seas. Secondly, you have the thing called the Zimmermann Telegraph, which many of you have heard about. This is a telegraph that the Germans sent to their ambassador in Mexico through the United States, because that's where the cables went, telling their ambassador to get with the Mexican president and let him know that if they declare war on the United States, if Germany and the United States go to war, if Mexico will side with Germany, when the war's over, they'll get Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona back. Now, in today's world, if such a telegraph were found to be existing, Germany would just deny it. They'd say, well, we never sent that. We don't know what you're talking about. But in 1917, Germany, who believes in the righteousness of their cause, says, yeah, we told them that, and we stand by that. And this, of course, infuriates America, which is already having problems with Mexico, as you know. The third reason, not so much outlined, although hinted at by Wilson in his speech, is that Wilson has this idea of, for lack of better phrase, manifest destiny, not just for the country, but for himself, as the brilliant political leader who is going to restore the order of the country, which has become corrupted politically and economically. He is going to lead the United States of America into this golden age of perfection. And consequently, because he will be so successful at this, he is also going to lead the world to this same idea. And by getting the United States into the war, he truly and honestly believes that this is the moment for which he was born. This is how he's going to fulfill his ultimate destiny, by becoming that leader. Now, this is a side of Wilson that very few people are aware of, that he has this vision of himself. But the question becomes, where does he get that vision? Did it come the night before the speech when he supposedly met with this newspaper reporter and poured out his soul? Well, as we will find out later, that story is completely made up. It never happened. And yet the story, which portrays Wilson as this great humanitarian who understands the depths of American republicanism and the evils of war, is used to create a play which becomes a huge hit on Broadway. It runs for 435 nights on Broadway, which in the 1920s is a huge hit. Today, maybe not so much, but in 1920s, because of the way Broadway worked, that's a huge, huge success. It's made into a movie in 1926, which you can still see. I'll link it on my page today. And in 1957, the film is remade by James Cagney. You would kind of recognize it today in the vein of Catch-22 or MASH as very anti-war humor. And it's all based on this supposed conversation that Wilson has, where he doesn't really want to, he knows that war is bad, but at the same time, it's going to destroy America. And we need.
So that story's a PR piece?
That story is a PR piece for the play. The writers of the play put this story out. Of course, the problem is the two people that were involved in this conversation have been now dead when they tell this story, so there's no verification of it. But there's okay. Also no record of this guy ever having gone to the White House on that day. So the story is seen as pretty much made up. But
he probably left his cocaine in a box in the entryway, too.
It's very possible. But at the same time, it becomes this huge hit, and it portrays Wilson in this very positive light that ignores the real Woodrow Wilson, who, by the way, has this vision of himself being this, again, authoritarian, dictatorial type leader, the type of president we would never recognize, the very type of president that many people accuse one of the candidates now of wanting to be. Mm-hmm. It isn't a conspiracy theory. It's reality. Woodrow Wilson wrote this stuff down, that this is what he wanted to see done. And as he stands before Congress on this day in 1917 and calls for the country to go to war, he really sees this as opportunity for himself and, of course, you know, kind of the nation too, because we've got a lot of money invested in Britain and France, and we need to protect that investment.
So the country and the world, because Wilson is the man.
He's the man. He believes this. Oh, and he's got people telling him that too.
Well, there's nothing like having yes men around you if you're a politician, right?
Especially if you have a really good one.
Ego, you're doing the right thing. Here we go. Keep it up.
Yep. Especially if you have a really, really good one telling you that, yeah, you're doing the right thing. And
well, if they're good at the argument and they're persuasive, why would you not believe it? Especially if your ego led you there anyway. More Dave Does History when we continue in moments on Bill Mick Live here on WMMB.
Our weekly dive into history. Dave Bowman joins us on Bill Mick Live.
The McPherson Financial Group, this hour, sponsor of the program. Let's jump back into Woodrow Wilson and what actually went on here, Dave. It sounds like an interesting story.
So Woodrow Wilson, like I said, he's had this long vision of himself as this, I don't want to call him supreme leader, but he certainly believes, and he's written a book about it, that he and he alone has the plan for how we're going to save the United States from all these problems that we're having, a corrupt government, an unequal justice system, and an unequal economic system, which is weird because Wilson is racially biased, possibly one of the most racially biased presidents we've ever had. So you can read into that what you will. He is really... He reminds me a lot, I don't know if you've ever seen the film Demolition Man with Sylvester Stallone. It's the official film of Afternoons Live with Dave and John, by the way. But the main character, Raymond Cocteau, the guy that creates this perfect society, Wilson is a lot like him. And again, this isn't my theory. This is what Wilson wrote about himself in a book.
It sounds like typical campaign rhetoric. But he's a sincere believer and knows he's the guy.
He's the guy.
Okay.
Now, if you were going to look at him, his book, I mean, he basically comes up with these ideas that he wants to do. He wants to do political reform. He wants to emancipate Americans from big business. He wants to do banking and tariff reform, government role and regulations. He wants to reform politics because it's corrupt. Now, the weird thing about all this is that Wilson has a friend who is a very good friend, very close friend. He is Wilson's political advisor. And he becomes Wilson's political advisor right around the time Wilson decides to run for president in 1912. His name is Colonel House, which is odd because he's neither. He's not a colonel or a house. He's never been in the military, but his name is Edward House. And he has written a novel, Bill, a work of fiction in which he describes a fellow by the name of Philip Drew, D-R-U. And in this novel, Philip Drew has come to believe that the United States of America is corrupt, the political systems are bad, the economics aren't fair, the courts aren't working well, the military is being used incorrectly, and so Philip Drew is going to take over everything. And he...
Oh, it's a novel based on contemporary events, right?
You could look at it that way.
Yeah, okay.
But it's written by Wilson's best friend. And Philip Drew is going to save the world for democracy.
So we've got a novel that's basically describing the author's best friend who... So he sees Wilson as this savior guy? Is that what... Or does he convince Wilson that he is?
It's almost like House has read Wilson's book, or possibly Wilson read House's book. But either way, the two characters, Philip Drew, who is fictional, is remarkably similar to Woodrow Wilson in personality, in thinking, and in vision of what they're going to do. Now, the part that Wilson that people don't like to talk about is we portray Woodrow Wilson as this academic. He was the president of Princeton University, don't you know? What we don't talk about is Princeton University wanted to get rid of him because he was an autocrat who wanted to run everything himself. Mm-hmm. And they didn't want him to do that. And it was just sort of a confluence that of events that he ends up running for president, so they got rid of him as president of Princeton University without having to actually fire him. So you've got this book by Philip Drew, which tells this remarkable story, and you can still read it. It's available free. Again, it's linked up on my page today. It tells this remarkable story of Philip Drew who takes over the United States of America to reform all the politics because the politics are so corrupt and the economy is so corrupt and so unfair and the judicial system is so unfair. And it's all about how he goes about doing this in a way that's designed not to be too disruptive. In other words, he doesn't want a lot of violence. He doesn't want a revolution in the sense of people shooting at each other in the streets.
Not a lot of violence.
Right.
A mostly peaceful protest.
Mostly peaceful, probably even actually mostly peaceful.
Okay.
And in the book, he actually pulls this off, Bill. In the book, he becomes the leader of the United States of America. And he begins to initiate all of these reforms, all of these things that Wilson has outlined in his book that he wants to do. Economic tax reform, political reform, social welfare, labor laws, military systems. He wants to fix the judicial system, and he wants infrastructure and public works, environmental conservation. And all of these things begin to come to pass in this book, Philip Drew, Administrator, that, again, draw almost directly from Wilson's book, which is called The New Freedom, an emancipation.
Which was published first?
Wilson's book is actually an amalgamation of his speeches.
Okay.
So his speeches probably came first before House's book.
Okay.
But the actual books are published around the same time. So it's however you want to look at it.
Back to a PR campaign.
Yeah.
Okay.
His book is The New Freedom, a call for the emancipation of the generous energies of a people, the American people. He wants to really reform the United States of America into his own vision of what it should be. And he believes that he and he alone has that vision. He alone has the ability to make this happen. And when World War I comes along, boy, now it's not just America I can fix, it's the whole world I can fix. And when he stands in front of Congress on April 2nd, 1917, this is probably what's going through his head. We're going to save the world for democracy. Of course, it's his version of democracy. It's his version of the rights of mankind. It's his version of what the world should be. Which, by the way, most of the rest of the world, if not most of America, is not all that impressed with. But then again, maybe they hadn't read the book. It didn't really sell that well, so why would they know what Wilson was thinking?
Well, the PR campaign was out there. They could get it going anyway.
Yeah, but he did win. So I guess, of course, the reason he won could be a conspiracy too, Bill. The reason he probably won was because Teddy Roosevelt split the Republican vote. And if he hadn't done that, maybe he's not the president, and maybe we don't go into World War I. Those are things to consider.
What was the temperament of the country as far as entering that?
There was a lot of resistance to World War I in the Midwest, but most of America was right on board with it.
Very good. And we talk how it all came together and the aftermath as we continue. Dave Does History right here on WMMB. Stay with us.
Call Bill now, 321-768-1240.
The McPherson Financial Group, this hour, sponsor of the program as Dave Bowman takes us through this edition of Dave Does History, looking at our entry into World War I and everything behind Woodrow Wilson making that jump. All right, Dave, where are we? Oh, by the way, there are links to Dave's podcast page, also to his Dave Does History bibliography posted for you on the show page today at BillMick.com. That headline is Conspiracy of the Month Club, and it's at the bottom of the story list there. You'll see both of those links for Dave. Right there. So, Dave, where are we at now on this thing?
Which, by the way, you'll want to look at today because I have I found both versions of the film What Price Glory, which is the play based on this mythological conversation between Wilson and this reporter. So,
oh, that'll be pretty good.
One of them is a silent film from 1926, and one of them is a James Cagney film. So, there you go. As Wilson and the nation declare war, and we begin to enter the World War. It's kind of an interesting calculation. Germany, Imperial Germany, doesn't believe that the United States will actually send troops to Europe. They don't think we can. They look at our military as very weak, very ineffective. Remember, we've been battling Pancho Villa for the last 2 years unsuccessfully. Our army has been chasing Pancho Villa all over northern Mexico, southern Arizona, New Mexico for 2 years, haven't been able to do anything about it. The Navy isn't seen as particularly strong, and the Germans really believe that unrestricted submarine warfare is going to win the war for them. So when Wilson comes into this thing, he comes into it with his very Philip Drewish attitude. He believes that he has begun to reform the United States. He's brought into to place constitutional amendments that have reformed how America does things, some laws. He's brought in the 16th and 17th Amendments. We're headed towards the 18th and 19th Amendments. He now has the opportunity, much as Philip Drew does after he takes over the country, to deal with international affairs. And Drew's position in the book is he emphasizes peace and cooperation. But he's prepared to defend the country against external threats, which, again, you could just replace Philip Drew with Woodrow Wilson, and that's his vision of how he's going to do these kinds of things. He's going to begin to carry out the same things internationally that he believes that he has done domestically. And Wilson's ideas for how we're going to end this war in Europe, peace without victory, are controversial. Here in the United States, not so much. But in Europe, where they have been fighting this war now for nigh on to 4 years, they're kind of hearing what Wilson has to say, and they're saying, yeah, that's nice. When are your troops going to get here? When are your guns going to get? When are you going to actually get out here, you know, on the actual battlefield and do some things that are useful rather than just running your mouth? And it's going to take some time. It's going to be several months before American troops are engaged in Europe. But once they are, they prove to be fairly effective. And it's the United States' weight, particularly with regards to supplies, that are going to tip the balance against Germany and ultimately result in the armistice, which will come in November of 1918, about a year and a half from the day Wilson gives his speech. But the problem is, Wilson's ideas, which in his head are the best ideas and the best ways of doing things, aren't really seen that way. Which is kind of weird because it's almost like he doesn't read the ending of Colonel House's books, because Philip Drew, who has taken over the United States, reformed everything the way he wants it, comes to the realization, Bill, that in order to accomplish what he wants to accomplish, what he has wanted to accomplish, he has to, like the Sith, like Darth Vader, he has to become the very thing that he swore to destroy. In enforcing his will upon America, he's become the totalitarian evil that it was supposed to be against, that he was supposed to be restoring.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so Philip Drew, in the novel, steps down and says, okay, go back to having elections because we can't have it both ways. We can't say we're a democracy and have a leader like me. I mean, it's just not going to work. Now, Wilson never actually gets to that point. He's over in Europe after the war explaining to everybody that, you know, we need to be friendly. We need to have this League of Nations. We need to have peace without victory, which England and France are never going to go along with. And so Wilson's vision, not just for the country, but for the world, pretty much collapses. And it ultimately ends when he has a stroke. And while he's still alive, is he really the president? You want to talk about a conspiracy theory? Most people believe that his wife actually starts running the country after his stroke. The lesson being very simply that Woodrow Wilson, portrayed in this play as this all-knowing, all-seeing visionary who had this idea that war is so bad that it's going to destroy the country, was anything but that. He, in fact, saw himself as the one man, the singular leader who could change not just the country but the world. And like every other one that's ever thought that, he failed.
And we pick it up, your calls ahead, on a Dave Does History on Bill Mick Live, just a minute away. Wrapping up Dave Does History on this Tuesday morning on Bill Mick Live. Dave, I don't get sidetracked too often in thought while we're talking about this, but as you were talking about the American influence in Europe in World War One, one of the things that popped into my head was, where was Ike Eisenhower at this time? Because it would be 20 years later, and he's going to be in a position of doing this again.
Like so many military officers of that era, George Patton, Douglas MacArthur, Chester Nimitz, he's in the military, he's in the army. If I'd have to look up his specific service during World War One, but if I'm completely off the top of my head, I believe he was in theater. I know MacArthur was. I know Harry Truman was there as an artillery captain. So,
wow.
Future leaders of America tended to serve in the military and they tended to be there. And there was a lot of positive viewing of this idea that we had to go save democracy. In fact, when Pershing gets to France, he goes to the tomb of Lafayette and he says, "Lafayette, we are here." In response to when Lafayette came to America and the French came to America during World War or during the American Revolution, which you could argue was World War One, but at any rate, this whole thing is, it's very patriotic, and that's the whole point of the play that's written, is it's very patriotic. If you watch the James Cagney version, if you love military music and military marches and Sousa marches and very positive portrayals of the American military, it's a great movie. But it has that undertone of war is bad, very MASH, very Catch-22, war is bad, you know, we've got to be careful about how we're doing these things, and there's a very anti-war feel to it. And it's all based on that fake conversation that Wilson allegedly had with his newspaper reporter talking about how he's so scared of what's going to happen to America, which is completely not Woodrow Wilson. I mean, that's Woodrow Wilson didn't care about any of that stuff.
To the phones we go. Line one, you're up on Bill Mick Live. Good morning.
Eric from Brevard.
Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
So, Dave, I was curious. At this point in world history, I think the Enlightenment Project was pretty well established. you know, running through the culture. But what was, we were talking about this, late last week about natural rights. I mean, what was Woodrow Wilson's view of human rights versus natural rights? Was like the permutations of his understanding of where rights come from.
Interesting question. Go ahead, Dave.
Well, not Eisenhower. Wilson is he's a strange character to look at when stuff like this. Remember that Woodrow Wilson he's a Southerner. And so like we talked about last week, as a Southerner, he is extraordinarily racist. He's raised in the Reconstruction era in the South. He is very anti-equality when it comes to African Americans, but he has these called progressive ideals in the sense that he wants to get away. He wants to make things equal. He doesn't like the Electoral College. He wants to go to direct democracy. He wants to do those things because he believes that his ideas are very popular.
Popular.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, again, the 16th and 17th Amendments are very populist ideologies. They're very populist amendments. And Wilson is a big part of that. Tax reform, those kinds of things. He's such a strange creature, and nothing in his writings would construe to you that he is a big believer in natural rights, primarily because of his, what I would call his Southern influence, but he's very cagey. And Woodrow Wilson, there are other chat show hosts that I won't name, but they rhyme with Glenn Beck, will tell you that, you know, Wilson is the worst president in history. I don't know if that's true or not, but I do know that he is one of the most misleading presidents in history, because what we've been taught is he's this very thoughtful, academic, concerned about the Constitution, and nothing could be further from the truth. And in fact, it's Wilson's administration that pushes through the very laws that we're told that he's afraid of, the Espionage Act, the Alien Sedition changes, and ends up throwing Americans in jail because they dare criticize him during the First World War.
Line two, you're up next on Bill Mick Live. Good morning.
Good morning. This is William Melbourne.
Yeah, William.
Let's fast forward 100 years and say, isn't that exactly what's happening today? Oh, it's amazing. You're talking about it. 100 years ago, and they want peaceful protest? No. I don't think it's going to happen, because this guy is going right now doing the same thing. He's fooling the public. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, William. Glad you're with us. Dave, we got about a minute to wrap it up here.
Well, as my grandfather of blessed memory would have said, there's nothing new under the sun. And Woodrow Wilson is nothing new. I mean, history is replete with people who believe themselves to be somehow or another, whether divinely or universally blessed, to be that leader. And Wilson clearly believed that about himself. He wrote this in his own books. And then you have the House book, Philip Drew, administrator, that kind of parallels that. And keep in mind that the guy that wrote Philip Drew is the guy that's whispering every day into Wilson's ears what he should do.
Both movies, What Price Glory, 1926 and 1957 version, and the book, Philip Drew Administrator, the full book, at thedavebowmanshow.com. The McPherson Financial Group brought to the hour. Dave, thank you. Another interesting Dave Does History.
We'll see you next week.